podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 434 for March 12, 2021. Zero Trust in a Remote World.
This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Nareva. Getting your audio ready for meetings back in the office? Nareva Audio is designed for distancing. It automatically adapts to new room configurations so you're ready for the new normal and whatever comes next. Learn more at nareva.com/twit. And by Worldwide Technology and NetApp. WWT's Advanced Technology Center is a virtual testing and research lab with the best engineers in the industry. WWT's ATC provides customers unbiased results so they know they are making the right technology decisions for their organization. To learn more and see what they can do for you, go to WWT.com/twit. And by Four Networks. Four Networks reduces business risk by revolutionizing the way large networks are managed. Their advanced software delivers a digital twin of the network, a completely accurate mathematical model in software. Get a demo at fournetworks.com/twit.
Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech. I am your host, Kurt Franklin. Now, those of you who are frequent viewers and listeners will have noticed that I am not, in fact, Lou Maresca. Our regular host will be back with us next week if things work out properly. Big news on his part. I'll let him tell you all about it. But before he is back to talk us through his changes, we've got a lot to talk about here on this week's episode of TWiT. We're going to be talking security. We're going to be talking zero trust. Well, we're going to be talking all kinds of things. To help me do that, I've got two fabulous co-hosts, beginning with our former geek in paradise, now new geek in the Sunshine State, Brian Chi. Brian, welcome to TWiT. What's been going on in your part of the world?
Well, I have managed to complete the move to Florida. I'm actually sitting in Kurt's dining room. We're waiting on the house down the street to close, and then I'll be able to say I'm a Florida man.
We are sure looking forward to that, looking forward to being able to call you a genuine neighbor as well. Someone who's not quite as close, not quite in such a warm place, is our other co-host, Brian McHenry. Brian, how are things up in the frozen Northland?
Well, we've finally got our spring thaw. It actually is topped out about 65, 70 degrees the last 2 days, and the last of the snow is slowly ebbing away. I'm also excited to report that F5's Agility Conference has opened for registration, so customers who are interested in labs and hands-on stuff can head on over to F5.com and register for their customer conference, which will be, of course, virtual.
Glad to hear about a conference, even if it is virtual. I think you and me and everyone else, well, we're looking forward to the time when we can get back together face to face. Well, we've got a great show today. We have a superb guest. We have the president and CEO of Ericom here, David Canellos, who's going to talk with us about lots of exciting things going on with them. Before we do that, though, we've got a couple of pieces of news we want to share, so let's dive right in to the blips. Sigstore aims to improve the open source software supply chain by simplifying the process of cryptographic software signing. This week, the Linux Foundation announced the launch of Sigstore, a new nonprofit initiative that aims to improve open source software supply chain security by making it easier for developers to adopt cryptographic signing for different components of the software development process. Sigstore will be free for software providers and developers who can use it to securely sign software artifacts like release files, container images, binaries, and bill of material manifests. Signing materials are then stored in a tamper-proof public log. The service's code and operation tooling will be fully open source and maintained and developed by the Sigstore community. founding members of which include Red Hat, Google, and Purdue University. Now, SigStore relies on the OpenID authentication protocol to connect certificates to identities. This will allow developers to use security controls they already have, like multi-factor authentication, one-time passwords, and hardware token generators. Because these keys are short-lived, there's no concern about keys potentially being left open and vulnerable to compromise. There's nothing left for the developer to manage, and all activity is recorded in the log. The team hopes SigStore will be made available later this year, though an official date has not yet been announced.
Well, T-Mobile next month will start a new program that gives customers web browsing and device usage data to advertisers unless customers opt out of the data sharing. Starting April 26, 2021, T-Mobile will begin a new program that uses some data we have about you, including information we learn from your web and device usage data, like apps installed on your device, and interactions with our products and services for our own and third-party advertising unless you tell us not to, says T-Mobile in their privacy notice. When we share this information with third parties, it is not tied to your name or information that directly identifies you. This shift to an opt-out model for tracking and privacy protection is a departure from recently acquired Sprint's practices, which were opt-in. Despite published instructions to opt out in T-Mobile's privacy notice, T-Mobile users have reported issues in successfully opting out via several links provided. This type of policy would seem to fly in the face of T-Mobile's branding as the quote-unquote user-friendly provider among the North American big three wireless companies such as Verizon, AT&T, and of course T-Mobile. What's more, the Wall Street Journal article said that T-Mobile is being more aggressive in sharing individuals' customers' internet usage data with advertisers than is AT&T and Verizon. Quote, AT&T automatically enrolls wireless subscribers in a basic ad program that pulls them into groups based on inferred interests such as sports or buying a car. An enhanced version of the program shares more detailed personal information with partners from customers who opt into it. Verizon likewise pulls subscriber data before sharing inferences about them with its advertisers, with a more detailed sharing program called Verizon Selects for users who enroll. Its separate Verizon Media division shares data through its Yahoo and AOL brands. T-Mobile claims that they anonymize this tracking using advertising IDs, but it is impossible for a customer to verify just how anonymous the use of these unique identifiers actually are. Privacy groups say these IDs can be linked back to people by comparing different data sets, according to the Wall Street Journal article noted on the T-Mobile changes today. Electronic Frontier Foundation lawyer Aaron Mackey adds, "It's hard to say with a straight face. We're not going to share your name with it. This type of data is very personal and revealing, and it's trivial to link that de-identified info back to you."
100 megabits per second uploads and downloads should be U.S. broadband standard, according to several senators. Four U.S. senators called on the Biden administration Thursday to establish a, quote, 21st century definition of a high-speed broadband of 100 megabits per second both upstream and downstream. This would be a big upgrade over the Federal Communications Commission broadband standard of 25 megabits per second downstream and 3 megabits per second upstream, which was established in 2015 and never updated by former President Trump's FCC chair Ajit Pai. Today's letter was sent to FCC Acting Chairwoman Jessica Rosenworcel and other federal officials by two Democrats, one independent who caucuses with the Democrats, and one Republican, noting that, quote, "the pandemic has reinforced the importance of high-speed broadband and underscored the cost of persistent digital divide in our country," quote, unquote, they wrote. "Going forward, we should make every effort to spend limited federal dollars on broadband networks capable of providing sufficient download and upload speeds and quality," quote, "including low latency, high reliability, and low network jitter for modern and emerging uses like two-way video conferencing, telehealth, remote learning, health IoT, and smart grid applications. Our goal for new development should be symmetrical speeds of 100 megabits per second, allowing for limited variation when dictated by geography, topography, or unreasonable cost."
Well, here's an interesting question. Can a programming language reduce vulnerabilities? When Microsoft wanted to rewrite a security critical network processing agent to eliminate memory safety vulnerabilities causing recurring headaches for the Microsoft Security Response Center, the company tasked an intern with the job and told him to rewrite the code in Rust. Rust, a programming language that's claimed the title of most loved among developers for 5 years in a row, could change the vulnerability landscape by practically eliminating certain types of memory safety errors. The language's claim to fame is that it provides the speed and control of C and C++ while delivering security and safety guarantees of other languages like Go and Python. Nearly 70% of the vulnerabilities that the MSRC processes are classified as memory safety issues, so eliminating that class of vulnerabilities is critical. More than a decade after Mozilla adopted and began rewriting code for its Firefox browser using Rust, the language may be ready to take off. While adoption continues to be anemic, for example, only 5.1% of developers use the Rust language, according to the Stack Overflow 2020 Developer Survey, a number of large companies have committed to using Rust in specific development projects. For companies, the decision boils down to the capabilities Rust does not allow. When the language is properly used, the compiler alerts on and refuses to compile certain coding patterns that lead to buffer overflows, use after free vulnerabilities, double free memory issues, and null pointer differences. For Microsoft, the errors that Rust can prevent account for the majority of vulnerabilities for which the company assigns CVEs.
Well, Google tells harassment victims to take quote-unquote medical leave, according to a recent report. Now, this report alleges that Google employees who report experiencing gender or racial harassment or discrimination routinely are told to take medical leave and seek mental health treatment, only to be shoved aside when they try to come back. Nearly a dozen current and former Google employees told NBC News that company HR officials told them to seek mental health treatment or take medical leave after colleagues made comments about their skin color or black hairstyles or asked if they were sexually interested in their teammates. Now, another dozen current and former Google employees told NBC that the practice is common within the company. Quote, I can think of 10 people that I know of in the last year that have gone on mental health leave because of the way they were treated, said one former Google employee. He himself had taken medical leave, quote, after he said he had numerous unproductive conversations with HR about how his colleagues discussed race. Now, these breaks mostly serve to push people out of the organization, either quickly or slowly, sources said. Multiple employees told NBC that when they returned from a recommended leave, they found themselves assigned to new managers or new parts of the company. Those changes, in turn, suppressed positive performance reviews due to lack of time to build up new relationships and work histories, and so those employees did not receive promotions or raises when they otherwise could have. Often considered one of the world's most desirable places to work, Google has lately become known as a toxic environment, particularly for minority groups. Women, especially black and Latino women, are drastically underrepresented at Google, according to the company's own data. As such, it's really no surprise to see a bro culture exposed as uncomfortable and often downright hostile to those groups. In particular, the December departure of well-known AI ethics head Timnit Gebru thrust Google's inclusivity efforts into the spotlight. Google said Gebru resigned, but Gebru, who is black, said Google pushed her out, describing a pervasive attitude inside the company to silence marginalized voices, including women and people of color.
Blue screen of the day. Update crashes Windows 10 PCs when they try to print. Sadly, a Microsoft Windows update is wreaking havoc with printers worldwide this week. KB5000002. For the newer Windows 10 builds, older Windows 10 and server builds may have a KB ending in 808 or 822 instead. Well, it was intended to provide updates to security, quote, when Windows performs basic operations, unquote, but the update crashes some print drivers due to overflowing a GDI object limit of 10,000. The bug affects a wide range of printers and print drivers. And the article confirms that the issue is on a Windows 10 2004 PC, which crashes with the APC underscore index underscore mismatch shown in the photo after printing to any of several models of Kyocera printers, some local, some network. Well, if you're afflicted by this bug yourself, you can get some relief by uninstalling the KB5000002 until Microsoft comes out with a fixed update, presumably by April's Patch Tuesday. I would really recommend you read the whole article and don't take this as blanket. If your PC OS is included before you do this update, you might want to just wait a little bit and get past this bump in the road.
Well, that certainly didn't take long. Attackers have begun to deploy ransomware on Microsoft Exchange servers compromised by the proxy logon exploits. Attackers have begun to utilize the recently patched Microsoft Exchange server vulnerabilities to deploy ransomware onto compromised servers, according to Microsoft. Philip Misner, a member of Microsoft's security research team, tweeted about the new ransomware family tracked as ransom:win32/dojocrypt.a and nicknamed DearCry, which is using the Microsoft Exchange vulnerabilities to target customers. The idea of ransomware taking advantage of compromised Exchange servers has been a concern since attack activity ramped up following Microsoft's patch release. Some cyber gangs gather terabytes of OSINT intelligence about internet software, and once there is a zero day, they sell compiled lists of IP addresses or URLs known to run the vulnerable software to other gangs. That's according to Ilya Kolachenko, founder and CEO of ImmunoWeb. This boosts the speed and efficiency of exploitation, he continued, and combined with ransomware, these attack campaigns bring huge and easy profits to these adversaries. Well, that's it for our blips. There's more news and a great guest to come, but before we get to those, we need to hear about a fabulous Twyatt sponsor. For that, Lou, over to you.
Thank you, everybody. Well, we'll have some more great stuff on Twyatt, but before we do, we have to thank a great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Nareba. As we think about heading back to the office, we know that the way we meet change. Distancing can have big implications for meeting room audio and may require changes in room configurations. The most important factor is the need for good mic coverage when people are distanced in a meeting space. But most conventional audio systems, they don't offer flexibility you need to actually easily accommodate changes. Now, beamforming systems will need to be adjusted often by really expensive technicians. Tabletop systems may require additional mics, and you may have to sanitize the mics between meetings. Now, both may require meeting participants to change their behaviors, like sitting in a predetermined spot and actually which direction they face. What if there was a better way to get clear, reliable audio and let your team act naturally and still feel safe? Well, Nareva Audio is designed for distancing. One analyst called Nareva Audio the first socially distanced mic system. Now, Nareva uses a completely original approach to audio conferencing called microphone mist technology. It fills a room with thousands of virtual microphones. And actually, I've demoed this before. It's very, very cool. Now, you get a true full room coverage so people can be heard from anywhere in the room, no matter where you are, where you sit or face, and how they are distanced. You don't need to bring in technicians with Nareva Audio. You can install each microphone and speaker bar on the wall yourself. And Nareva Audio automatically adapts to any room configuration. And microphone mist technology is so advanced, it has 4 patents. The Nareva Audio products have won numerous awards, including the Top New Technology Award at ISE 2020 for Nareva HDL 200 system. No matter the size of your room, they have full line of systems for small, medium, and large spaces. HubSpot is a happy customer. Jimmy Yan, their principal collaboration engineer, says, "We were so impressed with the sound quality, ease of install, and ease of use of the HDL 300. It was a no-brainer for us to adopt it." To learn more how Nareva Audio is the simple and cost-effective way to let your teams distance in meetings and still act and converse naturally, visit nareva.com/twit. That's nureva.com/twit. And we thank Nareva Audio for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now back to you guys.
Thanks, Lou. We appreciate you telling us about the sponsor, and we'll be hearing more from you later. But before we do, we've got a couple of bites. Both of them are about vulnerabilities, one concerning the way you get to something remote, the other on things that bring the remote back to you. For the first one, though, Brian McHenry is going to tell us all about something bad in VMware this way comes.
Well, there's a code execution flaw in VMware that has a CVSS severity rating of 9.8 out of 10. Attackers are mass scanning the internet in search of VMware servers with a newly disclosed code execution vulnerability with this 9.8 score. Entitled CVE-2021-21972, the security flaw is tracked as a remote code execution or RCE vulnerability in the VMware vCenter server, an application for Windows or Linux that administrators often use to enable and manage virtualization of large networks. Within a day of VMware issuing a patch, proof of concept exploits appeared from at least six different sources. Now, the severity of the vulnerability combined with the availability of working exploits for both Windows and Linux machines sent hackers scrambling to actively find vulnerable servers. Quote, we've detected mass scanning activity targeting vulnerable VMware vCenter servers, says researcher Troy Mersch of Bad Packets. Mersch says that the Binary Edge search engine found almost 15,000 vCenter servers exposed to the internet, while Shodan searches revealed about 6,700. The mass scanning is aimed to identify servers that have not yet installed the patch, which VMware released on Tuesday. Unfettered code execution with no authorization required allows hackers with no authorization to upload files to vulnerable vCenter servers that are publicly accessible over port 443. Researchers from security firm Tenable said successful exploits will result in hackers gaining unfettered remote code execution privileges in the underlying operating system. Now, the vulnerability stems from a lack of authentication in the vRealize operations plugin, which is installed by default. The flaw has received the severity score of 9.8 out of 10 on the Common Vulnerability Scoring System version 3, and Mikhail Klichnikov, the positive technology researcher who discovered the vulnerability and privately reported it to VMware, compared the risk posed by this CVE to that of the one from 2019, serial number 19781, a critical vulnerability in Citrix's application delivery controller. Now, the Citrix flaw came under active attack last year in ransomware on hospitals, and according to a criminal indictment filed by the Justice Department, its intrusions into game and software makers by hackers were backed by the Chinese government. Now, in a blog post earlier this week, researcher Klichnikov wrote, "In our opinion, the RCE vulnerability in the vCenter server composed no less a threat than the infamous vulnerability in Citrix. This error allows an unauthorized user to send a specially crafted request, which will later give them the opportunity to execute arbitrary commands, i.e. anything they want, after receiving such an opportunity. The attacker can develop this attack, successfully move through the corporate network, and gain access to the data stored in the attack system." Now, this vulnerability, once again, CVE-2021-21972, affects vCenter server versions 6.5, 6.7, and 7.01. Users running one of these versions should immediately update to 6.5 U3N, 6.7 U3I, or 7.0 U1C as soon as possible. And if you can't immediately install a patch, you should implement one of the workarounds that have been published, which involve changing a compatibility matrix file and setting the vRealize plugin to incompatible. Admins who have vCenter servers directly exposed to the internet should strongly consider curbing this practice or at least protecting it with the use of a VPN. Now, this raises many questions. Severe vulnerabilities, more and more of these being found for many vendors. The Citrix vulnerability was cited from 2019, VMware more recently, and even F5 this week, if I'm being totally transparent. We've all seen RCE vulnerabilities or remote code execution vulnerabilities over the last couple of years. So, you know, I want to talk to my co-hosts and get some insight here. One of the things is, you know, and I'll take this to my good buddy Brian Chi first. No bias towards the Brian here, but VMware is often thought, like Linux, to be immune from such things, and is really a big target that way. Should this school of thought be changing, Brian?
Well, I try to tell my students and a lot of other people, anyone that'll listen to me, what we're talking about is software that represents what in many cases is millions to tens of millions to hundreds of millions of lines of code. And when humans are involved, there's possibility of errors. Now, this starts getting into what I would call a best practice. Do you really want to expose any sort of management interface directly to the internet? My personal opinion is I do agree. vCenter should only be accessible via a VPN of some sort. Or what we'll do is we'll actually ask our friends, our guests from Ericom, because they're actually doing something similar. It's a VPN. It is a isolated browser. It is lots of different things. And it allows us to isolate, to almost even provide a proxy, you know, even though proxies are not a really good title for this. But anything that has humans writing code is going to have issues. And any hypervisor someday is going to have some sort of problem. Just like Linux has problems, Mac OS X or Mac OS has problems. Heck, even in the days when I was playing around with CPM, we ran into some really interesting security issues from time to time. So, yeah, best practices, isolate your management interfaces. And maybe, just maybe, some of these CVEs will be less painful. But, yeah. Everything, every OS on Earth has vulnerabilities, and gee, VMware, sorry, you guys are going to have vulnerabilities just like everybody else, and hopefully the best practices makes it less painful.
Thanks, Brian. That's absolutely great advice. I couldn't possibly add another thing. Now, I'd love to get Kurt's industry view. It seems like there's, as I mentioned, more of these types of CVEs, these really severe ones coming more all the time. Is this a trend you think is going to continue to accelerate, or do you think maybe the vendors will respond in some way and maybe stem the tide a little?
I think we'd all love to think that vendors could, over time, improve things to the point where there just aren't any severe vulnerabilities. But we all know that that's not likely to be true for a couple of reasons. Number one, systems are going to improve. That's something that we require as consumers, whether that's individual consumers or businesses. We want the hardware, the software, the systems that we use to get better. Every time they get better, new vulnerabilities are likely to be introduced. The other thing is that it's not reasonable to assume that any system is not subject to vulnerabilities. I think we could just go ahead and say that making that assumption is not a best practice. Best practice is to assume vulnerability. Best practice is to assume exploitation and therefore be professionally paranoid. So while this is unfortunate, the good news is that like most of these vulnerabilities, it has been patched. It's now up to the user organization to go ahead and patch that, apply the update, and then wait for the next vulnerability to appear. It's a cycle, but it's one we should all be used to and should all have adopted in our best practices. Well, that was an absolutely intriguing thing about, well, vulnerabilities. And we know from history and from a very imperfect crystal ball that we're going to be talking about many more vulnerabilities to come. You know, I teased a second blip, but the fact is we've got such an interesting guest. We're going to dispense with that and get right to our next guest. So, before we do, though, we've got to hear from our favorite host talking about a favored sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Lou, what do you have to say for us?
We'll get back to all the Twyatt goodness in just a moment, but first we have to thank a great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Worldwide Technology and NetApp. WAT's ATC platform brings together all the knowledge and resources you need to be confident that a solution is right for your organization. Their ATC lab contains more than a half a billion dollars in hardware and software from hundreds of technology companies. It provides a real-time tested proofs of concept tailored for every business, accessible anywhere and anytime. WWT uses their deep domain expertise and unique capabilities, coupled with their ability to deploy solutions at scale to create new realities for their customers. By consistently delivering technology and business outcomes, they have established decades-long relationships with many of their customers. Now, these organizations know WWT will help them achieve their goals. Their ATC is an incubator for IT innovation. Hundreds of on-demand and schedulable labs like NetApp Cloud Manager, representing the newest advances in multi-cloud architecture, security networking automation, primary and secondary storage, data analytics, and AI, DevOps, and so much more. Learn more about products before you launch. WWT's engineers use these environments to quickly spin up proofs of concept and pilots using the sandbox so customers can confidently select the best solutions. In many cases, this reduces concept time from months to weeks, which increase speed to market. They offer lab as a service, a dedicated lab space within the ATC. Here, customers can perform programmatic testing using the vast technology ecosystem that WWT has already built. It's virtual, so you can take full advantage of the ATC's unique benefits anywhere in the world 24/7. WWT's engineers work in these labs every day, beta testing new equipment and building reference architectures and custom integrations to help their customers make decisions and see results faster with much less investment. WWT's ATC platform encompasses the entire lab ecosystem, which creates a multiplier effect of knowledge, speed, and agility available anytime, anywhere around the world for its customers and partners. Access technical articles, insights, demonstration videos, white papers, hands-on labs, and other tools to help you stay up to date with the latest technology. While exploring the ATC platform, make sure you check out WWT's events and communities for opportunities to learn about technology trends and hear the latest research and insights from their experts. To learn more about WWT, the ATC, and become a member of their growing community, go to WWT.com/twit. to create an account and gain access to their on-demand labs today. Let WWT help you reach better decisions faster. That's WWT.com/twit. WWT, bringing strategy and execution together. And we thank Worldwide Technologies for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now back to you guys.
Thanks, Lou. We appreciate that. You know, we love the news here on Twiat, but our favorite part of every episode is when we get to talk to our guest. And this week we have a great guest. David Canellos, president and CEO of Ericom, is joining us. This will be the second time that we've had Ericom on the show. Way back in episode 249, we were talking VDI gateways and HTML5 with Ericom. We've got a whole new list of things we're going to be talking about today. David, welcome to Twiat. Thanks for joining us.
Brian, thanks for having me.
Well, you know, one of the things that all of our listeners enjoy is understanding how our guest came to their current position in tech. Can you give us just a little bit of insight on the long and winding road that led you to the CEO's office there at Ericom?
Yeah, sure thing. I'll keep it short, Kurt. I got into the cybersecurity industry almost 18 years ago, not because it was hot or the trading multiples were great, but really around a core belief that the growing online world must be safe, especially in today's world. And just listening to you guys, as more people and organizations and things go connected and digital. As for how I got to Ericom, it was really three things. One, it was cloud zero trust. Two, Israel, startup nation. And three, no institutional money. What more could I want?
It does seem like a perfect recipe for, well, adventure, if nothing else. And you mentioned something in your introduction there that I want to, you know, talk about just a little bit more. You talked about zero trust. And from where you're sitting, has zero trust become just the way things are done in security today, or are you still having to explain the concept and talk about why it's important when you talk to others in the industry?
Great question. It's, I'd say over the last 12 to 18 months, it's taken off with the support of the analyst community, vendors, and even the pandemic, driving a lot of the outcomes that we're seeing, and really the industry adoption of zero trust architecture. NIST wrote about it. Obviously, you've seen ZTA. And so there's gaining momentum behind this sort of least privileged access, where in an environment where most of us are in a remote distributed working world, how do you access the web and applications in a secure way? And that has been something that our customers are talking to us about. And you mentioned earlier about zero trust and specifically the browser and vulnerabilities. That's one area that I think is really seeing a surge in demand.
Well, you know, you're talking about the surge in demand. When we talk about different things being isolated and different things being segmented, is the browser something that specifically you see value in being segmented from the rest of the application stack? Or is it simply one of the bits of evolution, and that every bit of the application stack should be isolated from every other piece?
Well, let's start with the browser. It's now all I need is a device, an internet connection, and a browser, and I'm on the new dial tone, which is the internet, right? And if you keep up with the browser manufacturers, they're continually playing this cat and mouse game to address some of the CVEs, the vulnerabilities that you guys talked about earlier. And so if there are 2 billion users of Google Chrome, which represents nearly 70% of the market share, how are you going to keep up with so many users actually accessing websites that may contain malware, zero-day malware, phishing attacks through email phishing, and ransomware? So the cyber attackers are looking for those vulnerabilities in these browsers to issue these attacks. And so our opinion at Ericom is it's super important to isolate the browser activity from the internet, because the internet, as you guys have talked about just on this show, is certainly full of vulnerabilities and things of that nature that really can take down a company. So we see the browser as something, as a key piece of real estate that needs protecting.
Well, I certainly can see that. And I'm going to ask what may be a really difficult question. We all know that in an ideal world, everyone would be running the same version of the browser, and each of those browsers would be talking to the same version of the back-end web servers. But in reality, there are lots of versions of both. So does the kind of isolation that you're talking about work in this world where there are so many different versions of both ends of this transaction? Or in order to make it work, do we somehow have to get to some unified version of each end of this transaction?
What a great question, Kurt. Look, everyone's lives would be a lot easier if there was one operating system and one browser and one standard for websites. But the reality of it is that's not the case. And so the innovation that we've done here at Ericom was the ability to work with whatever local browser you have, whether it's Chrome, Safari, Firefox, and whatever device it's on, whether it's on a Mac, Windows, iOS, Android device, and to be able to allow organizations to connect to any website in a secure way. And the reason we're able to do this is because we have this cloud-based isolation platform that essentially renders the website in an air-gapped environment, and it executes the request. So I want to go to abc.com, and I'm on an old version of IE, Internet Explorer. I go to abc.com. On my behalf, the Aracom Remote Browser Isolation Service in the cloud is actually fetching the request and actually executing that request in this browser container, air-gapped away from my network, from my device, from my browser. And what I get as an end user is a visual stream, a safe visual stream from that Aracom Remote Browser Isolation down to my, in this case, Internet Explorer. And so for me as a user, the most important thing is the native experience. I have no client from Aracom on my endpoint. I get the same experience as if I go natively directly to abc.com, but I'm going through this intermediary, this isolation environment that's actually rendering safe content. And so what's happening here, and this is the key thing, is that the rendering activity, that's where we crack the code, is the ability to render. And think about mapping millions and millions of websites and billions of web pages and be able to render that quickly, efficiently to any user on the planet, on any device, any browser, in a very native way. And that's really the innovation that we've been working on for years and years at Aracom. And as I mentioned earlier, we're seeing a surge in the adoption of this just in the last few years.
Okay, I want to bring my co-host in, but before we do, we have a couple of things, and one of them is a question. You know, when you were explaining the isolation, I'm curious now, is this being done as a gateway? Is this SaaS? Is this a cloud environment? Is this an appliance that has to be stuck on someone's network? How are you making this isolation happen and doing this rendering that you were talking about?
Yeah. So the intellectual property is in multiple places. One is the rendering capability, and we have multiple modes of rendering based on your appetite for risk, your risk posture. And I won't get into them here, but we have pixel mode, we have frame mode, we have crystal mode, which is DOM mode. So there's different types of modes that we can transmit the virtual stream down to the endpoint where the browser resides. But the key thing for us is this is delivered as a service. So think of Aracom as a cloud service provider of zero trust security. And the way we're doing it is we have a federated system of POPs, of points of presence, globally interconnected, that are sitting on different infrastructures of service. And as a user of the Aracom Remote Browser Isolation product as a service, I'm in Northern Virginia, right outside DC today. I will connect to Ashburn. If I fly down to see you guys in Florida, in Miami, I'm going to go ahead and the system automatically, using proximity-based routing, will say, ha, he's in Florida now, connect him to the closest POP. So the closest POP in that case, points of presence, is going to be in Miami, for example. So we've orchestrated a way to make sure that the service is delivered as a SaaS cloud-based application, and it's done in a way that it travels with the user. Wherever I am, I'm going to go ahead and connect to the Aracom Global Cloud to protect my interaction with any website on the internet.
You are giving us a lot to think about, and we're going to be talking about it right after we get back from hearing Lou tell us about one more great sponsor for This Week in Enterprise Tech.
We'll go back to Twi in just a moment, but before we do, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Forward Networks. Your network is mission critical to your business. You know that. Now, Forward Networks will help you reduce network outages, improve troubleshooting, and eliminate errors. They reduce business risk by revolutionizing the way large networks are managed. Now, four Stanford PhD graduates developed Forward Networks 7 years ago when they developed empathy for network operators and sought to apply principles of modern software development to the network. Their advanced software delivers a digital twin of the network, a completely accurate mathematical model in software, and serves as a single source of truth for the network. Users can verify their network is configured correctly, it's in compliance with policies, and it's behaving exactly as they intended. They can accurately predict the impact of a proposed change across every possible traffic path, so network operators can roll out changes with confidence. This ensures that your network stays healthy and agile at all times. Now, here's some of what Forward Networks also does. Their dashboard provides key network insights with visualizations that are easily consumable, and they're exportable. Automatically create an always accurate network diagram with full details about the topology of your environment. Search network behavior and configuration and state network-wide with an intuitive and powerful tool. Perform end-to-end path analyses across your network for both on-prem and cloud infrastructures. Proactively identify potential connectivity and security policy violations as well. Verify that your network is configured and behaving exactly as intended across on-prem, cloud, and virtual overlay networks. Set, check, and customize your policies for your entire network. Behavior disks are really neat. They allow you side-by-side comparison in one quick view of configuration file changes for any device between any points in time. Get 50% faster resolution of network trouble tickets, 90% faster fixes related to audit processes, and 33% reduction in aborted network updates due to identified errors. Imagine searching your network for what is causing problems. Forward Networks allows you to do just that. Now, PayPal has been having issues with their network and considered building a better system. Instead, they turned to Forward Networks and found that all they needed was software that could find the troubled spots, saving them time and money. Forward Networks collaborates with a range of infrastructure and application technology partners, from the world's leading IT companies to innovators. They've worked with Bank of America, Verizon, Goldman Sachs, and several large government agencies. Forward Networks announced their Series C funding round last October, led by Goldman Sachs. Also participating were Andreessen Horowitz and Threshold, formerly DFJ. In total, their investors have committed $65 million. Get network automation and verification for your intent-based network with Forward Networks. Your business depends on it. Get a demo at forwardnetworks.com/twit. That's forwardnetworks.com/twit. And check out their new podcast, Seeking Truth in Networking. You can download it wherever you get your podcasts. And we thank Forward Networks for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now back to you guys.
We're here with David Canellos, President and CEO of Ericom. And boy, during our discussion so far, the back channel between the hosts has just been going crazy. I want to get to them. And to start with, we'll go to Brian Chee. Chiebert, I know you have a ton of questions you'd like to ask, but I'm going to have to ask you to keep it to just a handful of really great ones.
Well, we've been talking about all kinds of things. When we first talked to Ericom, we were concentrating almost a lot on VDI, but the world is changing. And to that end, Ericom actually came out with an announcement just recently on remote browser isolation. And why don't we go to that? And Dave, if you could go and make some comments on this. And I'm sure a lot of people are also asking, what's the difference between remote browser isolation and sandboxing?
Yeah, great question. So remote browser isolation, Ericom's had it now for several years. I think, Brian, the announcement you're probably referring to is we announced something very recently called intelligent isolation, where essentially we have telemetry that we're capturing from third parties and our own sensors on the network, and we're looking at this information in order to provide a great user experience and the proper security posture for organizations. And what I mean by that is we're actually looking at the URLs. We're looking at the spelling of the URLs, how the URLs can they be pronounced, so phonetically. What age are the URLs? What countries are the URLs from? And so it goes into an algorithm that we make determination whether this URL is safe or not. And so that's something that we announced as part of our is part of the Ericom Innovations Labs that we have here at Ericom that we announced earlier this week. Now, in terms of remote browser isolation, I think that the difference with sandboxing is there's nothing done online. This is an inline service, real time. So as a user, I noticed nothing different. As far as I'm concerned, I'm going to abc.com, and whether there's the Ericom remote browser isolation, RBI, in the middle or not, I'm none the wiser. So from a performance point of view, everything for me is the same. My same device is a MacBook Pro, Windows, Android, iOS device. I'm using a standard browser, Chrome, Safari, Firefox. There's no plugin. There's no agent on my endpoint. I'm none the wiser. I'm going as if I'm natively browsing to whatever website. The difference is that we're executing the request in a remote browsing environment in the Ericom Global Cloud. And as I mentioned earlier, we spin up these containers and we actually go ahead and process the request. And from that, we send a safe visual stream down to the endpoint. And again, I'm the end user. I don't even know Ericom's running. I'm clicking away. I'm cutting and pasting. I'm surfing the web, what have you. So everything is preserved from a user experience. It's a native experience. But most importantly, any of the bad stuff that can get rendered from going directly to the web, whether it's HTML, JavaScript, cascading style sheets, none of that makes its way down to my local endpoint or into my browser. It's all being executed in the remote execution environment in the Ericom remote browser isolation cloud. And the importance for that is that a lot of the malware is put into these areas, right? So even in JavaScript, most of the cryptojacking that gets onto your machine comes from JavaScript. So none of that stuff is executing on my local device. But as a user, again, I can't stress this enough. I don't even know that's happening. And that's really the cracking the code, where as a sandbox, to answer your question, that is an offline experience that you detonate a particular file or what have you, and then you look at the telemetry, you analyze the actual file, and then you make a determination, okay, I can go ahead and send this to the user, or I can quarantine or do whatever I want with it.
Super cool. Hey, just because I'm Mr. VDI, I love VDI, is Ericom's root still there? Are we still able to have VDI apps on premise for, say, like vCenter?
We can do them on prem. We have a cloud version of VDI now as part of the Ericom Global Cloud. That's our heritage, Brian. You know that from your earlier engagements with us. So that has really informed our ability to make this whole virtualization move into cybersecurity. So for us, it was a short putt to go from VDI and our knowledge and our roots over into the isolation of remote browsing. And so, yeah, we still sell that product. It's a great product. It's very competitive in the market. And for anybody who's interested, go to ericom.com and you check it out.
Fabulous. Now, we do have a real fast question from one of our folks in the chat room. DigMax was asking, can we still download and upload files to sites through your product?
Whoa. What a great question. Yeah. So download and upload of sites, of files. So we have, as part of our built-in capability in our remote browser isolation service, something called sanitization, file sanitization. So what we do is we actually do a CDR, content disarm and reconstruct. So essentially what we do is we take the file, we open it up, we sanitize all the active contents in the file, what could be bad. We put it back together, and then we deliver it to the end user. So most importantly, that to the end user that's downloading a file that may contain malware, ransomware, what have you, we go ahead and make sure we scrub and what we call sanitize the file for that exact reason. And it works both ways, upload and download.
Super cool. Sanitize for COVID. Hey, you know, Bam, our friend from F5's got some great questions for you. And I'd like him to go and take his turn.
Hey, thanks, G. I'm really curious because this is an exploding space, like zero trust and application access, and browser isolation technology. I think the first time I heard that term, I think it was the Bromium, which has since been acquired by HP. And certainly you've got folks like Zscaler with their big, some might argue, bloated CASB solutions. Could you walk us through what makes Aracom different from these other, these historical browser isolation solution? What makes them different from, the big, CASB suites? What gets Aracom customers excited about, what do you hang your hat on when you're going to talk to customers about your approach to these problems?
It's a very difficult problem to solve, and it's different than Cloud Access Security Broker or CASB. And CASB is looking at doing analysis on SaaS applications. And we're talking about not just SaaS applications, we're talking about any website and rendering that website or web page in a safe way to an endpoint that's on the network, on a device, protecting data. Now, your question about some of the older generation technologies that looked at browser isolation, they essentially did it on the endpoint. So imagine me on an endpoint, whether it's my MacBook Pro here in my office or my iPhone or iPad, is segmenting off the device, clean room, if you will, on the device and actually executing it locally. And then based on that, giving me access to it on the same device. The issue with that, and what was prone to some of these earlier generation browser isolation solutions, was you don't have the horsepower or the scale to do what you need to for thousands and thousands of users. And you ask what's different about us. What's different about us is there's nothing going on the endpoint. That's the whole thing. For us, it's all being done in the cloud. So we're harnessing the processing power in the cloud, where compute is getting cheaper and cheaper. And we've orchestrated these different points of presence around the world. So from a user experience and a performance point of view, it's minimal. So we've traded in the local browser isolation capability 10, 15 years ago, you mentioned Bromium, to now a cloud-based isolation platform where there's very few companies that are doing it and only fewer that are doing it very well.
Absolutely great insights there. And you hit on one of my favorite topics in security, which is user experience. And you've mentioned this a few times, how the user really doesn't notice a slowdown or any kind of performance disadvantage to using this technology, which everybody loves to hear. Could you talk us through a little bit about the other end of user experience, which is the administrator as the user, right? What does a rollout look like in the typical enterprise customer for Aracom's solutions? Is this just as seamless from the administrative end?
It's something that, Brian, we can have up and running in 72 hours. It literally is that simple. There's nothing to do on the client, only to make sure that they can see the Aracom Global Cloud from their device, and meaning the users. The administrator needs to ensure there aren't specific policies that they want to apply. For example, maybe I have researchers that need to go to the dark web, and they need access to that web. And so we also, we have this anti-phishing capability. So if we find a site that looks suspicious, we will go ahead by policy, by default policy, and render that site read-only. Why? Because what are the bad guys after in phishing? They're after the credential theft, right? Banking information, credit card information, login password information. So by default, if the website is not categorized in a URL categorization, and I mentioned our Aracom our data lake where we're storing all the telemetry, if it's not categorized, the URL, we're going to by default let folks go there in read-only mode. Again, for them not to exchange information with the bad guys, because it's a phishing site, right? And so if you have a set of researchers that need to dive deep into the parts of the web that aren't indexed, well, you're going to want this set of users access to certain things. So you'll give them permissions to say, okay, I want you to go into this part of the dark web. That's not index. But what we could also do is allow for that subset of users to go into that part of the web and flash up a message to say, look, you're entering into an area that could be a phishing site. Proceed with caution. And so by default, the administrator of the tool, and this is all through a web browser, very easy to administer, can go ahead and set those sorts of policies. So that's just one example of a policy on a user group that someone may want to apply.
Well, I could go on for literally another hour on this topic, but like all good things, I think this must also come to an end, and I'm just going to throw it back to Kurt here to wrap up for us.
Brian, thanks so much. Thanks actually to both of my co-hosts, the two Brians, and to our guest, David Kanellis, president and CEO of Ericom. David, before we let you go, how could our listeners who want to know more about what Ericom is doing in this area find out about it? Is there a website? Is there someplace they can go to hear more about it?
You bet, Kurt. If anybody wants to learn anything about Ericom, go to www.ericom.com. That's ericom.com. And in the upper right, there should be a contact tab that you can go to. Click on that, and you can send us an email. You can give us a phone call, access us in many different ways. We have presence on LinkedIn. We have presence on Twitter. Any way you want to reach us, by all means, reach out to us. We'd be more than delighted to talk more about remote browser isolation and the overall zero trust space.
We appreciate that. And I've got to ask, I mean this as the highest of compliments. You are incredibly well informed about the technology for a CEO. And so I'm curious, is there a blog or other place where they can follow your thinking about the technology, or should they just follow Ericom's social media in general?
By all means, follow at @Ericom_software on Twitter or Ericom Software on LinkedIn. Connect to me on LinkedIn by all means, or on Twitter. I do have a blog on Ericom.com. I also have a Medium site, so I do write my own opinions about this space. I do like to stay well informed about this space. It is mission critical to our customers, and so by all means, there are different ways to read up and keep up about us.
Well, David, thank you so much once again. That's David Kanellis, president and CEO of Ericom. We thank him, and we thank you, our listener. We could not and would not do this without you. You've been hearing me, but before we go, want to find out what my co-hosts have in store. Brian Chi, what's coming up with you, and where can people follow you around the interwebs?
Well, I'd love to hear from you. Twitter, I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, or you're more than welcome to drop me an email. I am chibert@twit.tv. But you know, why don't you drop a line to twiet@twit.tv, and that hits all the hosts. Still would love to hear from you. Just keep in mind, I'm on the East Coast now, and I will soon be a Florida man as we hope to close on our new house on April 9th. Looking forward to hearing from you and your show ideas.
Well, another East Coast Twiet co-host, Brian McHenry. Brian, where can people keep up with you, assuming you have any time when you're not responding to some of these unexpected vulnerabilities that come out?
Well, you can always find me at BA McHenry on Twitter, where I'll share things like the link to our announcement this week about F5's own vulnerabilities. Unfortunately, we're not immune either. There are four critical vulnerabilities in this set of fixes that we've released for all supported versions of code. And I encourage every F5 customer to go and check this out. We're running open office hours contact your account team. We're doing everything we can to help you get patched and stay secure. And we really appreciate every one of our customers' trust during this time, and we're doing all we can to help you. So thank you.
It is really great to be part of this crew. Now, if you're listening to us live, welcome. If you're not, remember you can always subscribe to us at twit.tv/Twiat. You can follow us on Twitter and watch the live show every Friday at 4:30 p.m. Eastern Time. We have a live chat room, irc.twit.tv. We would love to have you join us for that. Now, for my co-host, our guest, and everyone here at Twiat, thanks for being with us. Remember, if you want to know everything there is to know about enterprise technology, just keep Twiat.
Hey, if you like tech news, but you also like hearing about it from the people who are actually writing the stories, well, I've got a show for you. It's called Tech News Weekly, and it's me, Jason Howell, along with my co-host, Micah Sargent. Every week, we invite the people making and breaking the biggest tech news stories from around the web onto this show to talk to us about it. It's a lot of fun. You should check it out. Tech News Weekly can be found at twit.tv/TNW every Thursday. We'll see you there.